The passage is Isaiah chapter 5. And you'll be able to find the passage on the handouts. So Isaiah chapter 5. Let me sing for my beloved, my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. And he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. And he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, an outcry. Woe to those who join house to house, who add field to field, until there is no more room, and you are made to dwell alone in the midst of the land. The Lord of hosts has sworn in my hearing, surely many houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield but one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield but an ephah. Woe to those who rise early in the morning, that they may run after strong drink, who tarry late into the evening, as wine inflames them. They have lyre and harp, tambourine and flute and wine at their feasts, but they do not regard the deeds of the Lord, or see the work of his hands. Therefore my people go into exile for lack of knowledge. Their honored men go hungry, and their multitude is parched with thirst. Therefore Sheol has enlarged its appetite and opened its mouth beyond measure. And the nobility of Jerusalem and her multitude will go down, her revelers and he who exults in her. Man is humbled, and each one is brought low, and the eyes of the haughty are brought low. But the Lord of hosts is exalted in justice, and the holy God shows himself holy in righteousness. Then shall the lambs graze as in their pasture, and nomads shall eat among the ruins of the rich. Woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of falsehood, who draw sin as with cart ropes, who say, let him be quick, let him speed his work that we may see it. Let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near, and let it come, that we may know it. Woe to those who call evil good, and good evil, who put darkness for light, who put bitter for sweet, and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes, and shrewd in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine, and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who acquit the guilty for a bribe, and deprive the innocent of his right. Therefore, as the tongue of fire devours the stubble, and as dry grass sinks down in the flame, so their root will be as rottenness, and their blossom go up like dust. For they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts, and have despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against his people, and he stretched out his hand against them and struck them. And the mountains quaked, and their corpses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. For all this, his anger has not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. He will raise a signal for the nations far away, and whistle for them from the ends of the earth. And behold, quickly, speedily they come. None is weary, none stumbles, none slumbers or sleeps. Not a waistband is loose, not a sandal strap broken. Their arrows are sharp, all their bows bent. Their horses' hoofs seem like flint, and their wheels like the whirlwind. Their roaring is like a lion. Like young lions they roar, they growl and seize their prey. They carry it off, and none can rescue. They will growl over it on that day, like the growling of the sea. And if one looks to the land, behold, darkness and distress. And the light is darkened by its clouds.
Thanks, Brian. It sounds like you're really getting into it there at the end. We should have let you carry on. Good to see you, and can I add my welcome to Brian's, and especially if this is your first time with us, it's great to see you. You're going to need to keep that open in front of you, or if you do have a Bible, that might be even more sort of user-friendly than the sheets that we've given you. So our subject today is the fact that God must judge his own people. I don't know what knotty problems you've been given this morning in your emails, or that are waiting for you on your return to the office. Perhaps you have to do them yourself. Perhaps you can give them to someone else to deal with. But this is the problem that is at the heart of the Bible story, actually, and at the heart of the book of Isaiah that we've got in front of us. No problem is greater than this for a God who longs to have for himself a people holy, washed, who can be with him, live with him in his presence forever. And Isaiah begins his book, and we're not going to carry on immediately, but we've been going through the introduction of Isaiah, so chapters 1 to 5. And in his introduction, he begins with the problem. Chapter 1, "Ah, sinful people, my people, laden with iniquity." And he ends with the problem. Chapter 5, "The judgment must fall on my people." The effect of this chapter, I'm going to be suggesting this lunchtime, should in the first instance be deeply humbling for the Christian. This is a self-righteousness busting chapter for God's people. And I don't know about you, if you're a Christian person here today, we can be so quick, can't we, to begin to think highly of ourselves morally, to begin to feel superior to those around us. We might find ourselves saying, "Thank you, God, that I'm not like those people from that group in the firm who celebrate sin, boast in it. Thank you that I'm not like that sleazy manager who sleeps around, or who bullies people, or who's driven by purely selfish ambition for money at whatever cost to others." See, it would be easy to read these woes that Brian's just read and think, yeah, that's the city, isn't it? Just have a look down at verse 20. For an example, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil." Be easy to read that and for the Christian person to think quietly to themselves, yes, woe to the city for that. But I suggest that that would be a huge mistake, because God says, look more carefully at who this is about. Verse 25, "Therefore the anger of the Lord was kindled against his people." This is not about them out there, if you're a Christian. This is about God's people. That's the point. God must judge his own people. We've been seeing in these first five chapters, Isaiah saying again and again, after 700 years under the law of Moses, you are no better than Sodom. But there are two issues that this chapter deals with. Because I think one thing to say is that Isaiah could have just said, this is a long chapter, isn't it? He could have just said, God must judge his people for their own sin. But actually, there are two specific issues that Isaiah deals with in this chapter. Number one, Was it unfair of God to judge his people? And number two, couldn't he go easy on his people? So number one, wasn't it unfair of God to judge his people? And just look down again at the beginning of this chapter, and I think that is what this parable is about. Let me sing for my beloved my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it, cleared it of stones, planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it. He hewed it a vat of wine in it. He looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem, men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. This is the key, verse 4. What was there more for me to do for my vineyard than I have not done in it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? The point is this. God is saying, I've loved my people. I've loved you. What more could I have done for you? Looking back over the whole history of Israel at this point, 700 BC, looking back all the way back to Moses, to Egypt, God saying, I brought you out of Egypt. I showed you my power. I cleared you a land flowing with milk and honey, a promised land. I gave you my good law to live by. You were like the choice, the best vine. I took you. I planted you in the best soil, literally the fatty soil, fertile soil. I put you on a high hill where sunlight would shine. That's what vineyards need, a lot of sunlight. I cleared stones, all of the stones, and I protected it with my watchtower. In other words, God says to his people at this point, I made it so easy for you to love me and to obey me. It was the perfect conditions, right? If humanity was ever going to show ourselves capable of loving and obeying God in ourselves, it was Israel. That's the point. I loved you, God says, but what did you give me in return? Baffling rebellion. That's the point of the wild grapes, isn't it, verse 2? It yielded wild grapes for no reason. Baffling rebellion. They gave him the very opposite of what he had given them. And in verses 8 to 30, so this chapter is actually very simple the way it works. You've got the parable basically in verses 1 to 7, and then you've got verses 8 to 30, which spell out the parable. And as one commentator has put it, in 8 to 30, we see the wild grapes and the judgment that they deserve. And what we see in 8 to 30 is six woes. Okay, so just look at verse 8, woe. Verse 11, woe. Verse 18, woe. Verse 20, woe. 21, woe. 22, woe. So you get six woes and their consequences. And these six woes show us these six manifestations of human pride. Now, pride is the summary, I think. You get that in verse 15. Man is humbled, each one brought low. So what's this about? How do you summarize? How is God summarizing sin, the sin of his people? Pride. But in these six woes, you get the six shades of human pride, the six manifestations of it. Firstly, verse 8, greed. Woe to those who join house to house, who add field to field, until there is no more room, and you're made to dwell alone in the midst of the land. God says to his people, you are greedy beyond belief, with no concern for your fellow man. What space is left for them in the land? You've added house to house. You've created your empire for yourself. What can they eat? Where can they live? See the point? Greed, unbridled greed. So the first woe. The second woe, utter disregard for God, and that is verses 11 and 12. Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may run after strong drink, who tarry late into the evening as wine inflames them. They have lyre and harp, tambourine and flute and wine at their feast, but they do not regard the deeds of the Lord or see the work of his hand. Utter disregard for God. This is a picture of sort of, this is Ibiza, isn't it? The clubs and the bars of Jerusalem were full late into the night on a Thursday night. This is not about God saying you can't have fun. Jesus enjoyed a glass of wine and a wedding feast. It's not about that. This is about a headlong pursuit of pleasure in this world in utter disregard for God. A headlong pursuit of pleasure in this world in utter disregard for God. They had no interest in thinking about God or what he might be doing. Verse 12. No regard for the deeds of the Lord or for the work of his hands. They would not have been interested in coming to Isaiah's lunchtime talks in Jerusalem. They wouldn't have wanted to hear the words of the scriptures. No regard for God. Second woe, then, utter disregard for God. Third, and I think there's a sense of escalation here, verse 18, taunting God. Woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of falsehood, who draw sin as with cart ropes. So not only were they willing to sin, but God says you were actively seeking it out. That's the point. You're dragging sin after you. You're going to get it. You're seeking out sin. And then verse 19, they were saying to each other or in their hearts, let him be quick. Let him speed his work that he may see it. Let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near. Let it come that we may know it. You see what they're saying? Let the counsel of the Lord draw near. In other words, the counsel, his word about judgment. Let him come and judge if he's there. Let these so-called words of God come near that we may see that it's real. Come on, God, give us your best shot. Taunting, mocking the very idea that God would judge. They were sniggering in the bars of Jerusalem at Isaiah's promises of judgment. If he's there at all, they were saying, he can't even see us, let alone do anything about it. They were mocking the God who had tenderly rescued them from Egypt, had taken them into a land flowing with milk and honey, had given them the wine that they were drinking and the roof over their heads and the food in their bellies. Taunting, goading God as if he wasn't there. The fourth woe. So, disregard of God, taunting God. Fourthly, playing God. Verse 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light, light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. This is about redefining right and wrong. This is about not only dragging sin after you, but then the justification of my sin that goes with that. So saying, I'm not only going to do this thing, but I'm going to call it good. I'm going to write books about why it's good. I'm going to make laws that say it's good. It's about the redefinition of right and wrong. Playing God, therefore, the prerogative of God. The fifth woe, intellectual arrogance. Verse 21. Not only then did they ignore God, not only did they taunt God, not only did they play God, but they were so utterly convinced that they were wise. Verse 21. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and shrewd in their own sight. That they gave themselves a pat on the back for what they had managed to work out about the world, where we come from, whether or not God exists, if so, what he's like. They knew, they thought, about reality. They were in out and out rebellion against God, but there was no fear that they might have got things wrong. They were wise in their own eyes. They knew they were right. And then finally, the sixth shade of human pride, corruption. Verse 22 and 23. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and valiant men drinking strong drink, who acquit the guilty for a bribe and deprive the innocent of his rights. This, I take it, is about the pursuit of selfish interests at the expense of others. Now, if we're a Christian listening to all these woes, we might be thinking how well that describes the city, the LGBT plus group, the flag, the movement, the greed. One person describes his organisation like this. He says it's as if there's a trough of gold in the middle, and everyone's trying to sort of plunge their head into the trough, and the more senior you get, the closer you can get to it, so you can plunge your head in, and you can get, if you're sort of close to senior, then you get the sort of bits that come over the shoulder. The greed, yes, how well we might say this describes the city. And it does, because what we have here is six fundamental shades of human pride. But God says, it's not about them, Christian. It's about you without your Saviour. Now, we may be thinking, but it's not about me, it's about them, it's about the Jews. And that's a good question. That is a good question. Is this really about the Christian, or is this about the Jews? But can I put it to you that God doesn't see it like that in Isaiah, or indeed at all? Rather, he sees his people as one corporate person in Isaiah. We saw in chapter 1, didn't we, the unfaithful woman who would, through judgment, be made a glorious bride. The continuous one person. And so God's eye view is, this is my people. This was my people. If I can put it like this, through the history of Israel, God has given our hearts a 700-year test drive. We're used to the idea of a test, aren't we? I have a friend whose identity I should really protect because they had a difficult first driving test. He or she, I'll protect gender, he or she came out of the test centre, turned left and drove straight into a lamppost. They then turn to the instructor and ask, is there any point in carrying on? To which the answer was no. That was a very short test. We know, of course, that longer tests produce better results. That's why test match cricket is called test match cricket, because it's 5 days. A Boeing 747 had to be tested for 2,000 hours before it's ready to go. The human heart has been tested in the best possible conditions for 700 years. In fact, more accurately, the heart of God's people, your heart, my heart, if we're Christian. And this is what God found. God our Father says to you, look at this. This is what you're like. And we know we are, don't we? Without Christ, we know that's the person we become. And God says, what more could I have done for you, my people? It wasn't my fault. Should I not judge you for it? I must judge my people's sin. But, someone says, coming on to our second question, couldn't God go easy on his own people? Surely he can make an exception for his own beloved people. I mean, that must happen all the time in the city. The city boss makes an exception for their favourite employee, overlooks the sort of the email mess up or whatever it was, or as the Prime Minister might make an exception for his own birthday party or whatever it is. Couldn't he go easy on his own people? And I think that is the second burden of this chapter 5. Why didn't Isaiah just say God must judge his people? We need to understand, Isaiah says emphatically and shockingly, woe to them. No, there cannot be any favouritism in God. Just have a look down at verse 16. Why is that? Because God is holy. The Lord of hosts is exalted in justice. The holy God shows himself holy in righteousness. No, he cannot sweep his people's sinful pride under the carpet. And so we see not only that God must judge his people, but can you feel the fierceness of it? Woe means woe, God says. There are three chilling images, aren't there, in this passage. Number one, verse 14, of God opening the mouth of the grave to swallow up his people. Verse 14, therefore Sheol has enlarged his appetite and opened its mouth beyond measure. Sheol there means the grave. And so what we've got there is death pictured as having an appetite for people, hungrily devouring his people under God's instruction. Secondly, God will come at them like a fire, verse 24. Therefore, as the tongue of fire devours the stubble, and as dry grass sinks down in the flame, so their root will be as rottenness, and their blossom will go up like dust. Verse 25, therefore the anger of the Lord was kindled like a fire against his people. And then thirdly, like a lion, verse 29, the Babylonian army pictured as a lion, God saying, he's going to come and tear you apart. He will growl and seize his prey and carry it off. Now, sometimes we talk about God's settled wrath. I don't know if you've heard that phrase, God's settled wrath. And I was thinking about this. I think if we mean by that that he's not quick to anger, but patient, yes. But if we mean by that that he is like the judge in the Old Bailey or the High Court over there, calmly banging the hammer as the defendant is escorted off to his prison cell, no. God's anger is personal. It's fierce. It is vengeance for the way that he's been treated by those he loved and made. Couldn't God go easy on his people? No. Woe to them, Isaiah says. This is what the people of God deserve. This is what we deserve if we're Christian. And so I think that there's a question in this chapter, that this passage, that asks every Christian or would-be Christian, can we still say, woe to me without Christ? Lord, you would have been right to throw me in the grave, to come at me with fire, like a lion. This was me too. This humility, I think, must be the case for all followers of Jesus. At the end of Isaiah, God says, this is the one to whom I will look, him who is humble and contrite in spirit. The Apostle Paul is said of himself, I am the foremost of all sinners. The Apostle Peter wept when he realized what he was truly like. And so there should be no such thing as a Christian in the city, as you go back to your workplaces, if you are a Christian. No such thing as a Christian in the city thinking themselves superior to our colleagues. The person perhaps who's redefined their gender, or who's in an adulterous relationship, or who's an unpleasant bully. God says, remember, you were no better than them. Woe to me without Christ. And just two final implications, because I think we need to ask, where is all this pointing? And I want to put to us as we close, Isaiah is pointing us forwards in two ways. He begins his introduction with the problem, and that is the sin of God's people, the judgment we deserve. The exile, therefore, the Babylonian exile, is teaching us that God's people need a better, deeper, permanent salvation. The whole of Israel's history under the law has taught us God's people need a rescue, not like the rescue from Egypt, which was a political rescue, but a rescue from God and the fierce judgment that we deserve for our sin. We've seen in these chapters that there will be a permanent salvation. Isaiah declares, doesn't he, in a new Jerusalem, a fresh new work that God is doing through his branch. We've been there. But it will need to be a salvation from sin and judgment. That's the point. It will need to be through a Messiah who doesn't simply have the power to fix the external problems of the world, but who can somehow take away the sin of God's people for good, who can take their punishment away. Jesus, in the Garden of Gethsemane, the night before he died, Luke says, sweat drops of blood, terrified. Why? Because he knew that he was about to take the woe on himself that we deserve. Secondly and finally, just one very brief comment on this. I think this chapter also points us to the need for a fresh start for Israel. We talked last week about the fresh new shoot of the Lord, a completely new vineyard, right? This time with different roots, not the roots of the law of Moses, but the roots of the grace of God and his Messiah. And therefore, no wonder that Jesus says to his disciples, "I am the true vine, you are the branches." A new Israel, this time founded on the Messiah and the grace of God, and this time a vineyard that will bear fruit for God. Let's pray. Okay. Eight, would buying a second home or voting down at an affordable housing development make that sinful? I think the answer is no, not necessarily. God is using picture language to talk about greed, but we would always want to assess, therefore, our own heart and to ask, why am I doing this? Is it coming from a place of greed? Say again?
So what if it was to protect the value of your property? So that would then fall under the...
Greed. Not necessarily. I mean, sometimes it might be wise to... God isn't saying here it's wrong to own homes or even how many homes. He's using picture language to describe a pursuit of greed for myself. It's the heart issue, I think, that we need to ask about. It may be there are good reasons to buy a second home if we're going to be using it in good ways. It may be there are very bad reasons to buy a second home. But more fundamentally, I think God is saying through this chapter, just this is what we're like. This is our heart. And we know it. And we need a saviour. Yeah. It's very helpful. So to what extent does Jesus represent Israel and does he take on all of those things? I think to every extent. So I think that's where Isaiah goes. He becomes the new Israel, the new branch. And in chapter 53, finally, we find the solution. We find the solution to this problem, the problem of God's people's sin, as Jesus, the new Israel, takes on himself the transgressions, the iniquities of his people. That's the promise. There will be a servant who will, God says, I will send my servant. He will take the sins of my people on himself. In chapter 53 of Isaiah. So it's a big argument. And in the introduction, we get the problem laid out, but we don't get the solution. So in a sense, in the introduction, we have a Messiah-shaped hole, I would suggest, which Isaiah then goes on to fill in the rest of his prophecy. How are we going to get from A to B, the sin of God's people facing God's judgment, to B, glorified Zion, washed forever with the Lord? Well, the rest of Isaiah answers that question. It's going to be through a king. For unto us a son, a child is given, a son is born, who will live forever. It's going to be through a servant who will die for his people. So that at the end we're able to say, chapter 12, behold, God has become my salvation. He is my strength and my song. If we understand Isaiah, we'll understand that we've done nothing, we can do nothing, but God has become my salvation. God and his Messiah.